Star Tide Rising, Cassette 7.
Chapter 45. Tom Worley. A chilly sea breeze swept over him out of the west. A bout of shivering shook him awake in the middle of the night, his eyes open in the dark, staring into emptiness. He couldn't remember where he was. Give it a moment, he thought. It'll come. He had been dreaming of the planet Garth, where the seas were small and the rivers many. There he had lived for a time among the human and chimp colonists, a mixed colony as rich and surprising as Calafia, where man and dolphin dwelt together. Garth was a friendly world, though isolated far from other Earthling settlements. In his dream, Garth was invaded. Giant warships hovered over her cities and spewed clouds of gas across her fertile valleys, sending colonists fleeing in panic. The sky had been filled with flashing lights. He had trouble separating the trailing edges of the dream from reality. Tom stared at the crystal dome of Kithrop's night. His body was locked, legs pulled in, hands clutching opposite shoulders, as much from a rigor of exhaustion as from the cold. Slowly he got the muscles to loosen. Tendons popped and joints groaned as he learned all over again how to move. The volcano to the north had died down to only a feeble red glow. There were long, ragged openings in the clouds overhead. Tom watched pinpoints of light in the sky. He thought about stars. Astronomy was his mental focus. Red means cool, he pondered. That red one there might be a small, nearby, ancient, or a distant giant, already in its death throes. And that bright one over there could be a blue supergiant. Very rare. Was there one in this area of space? He ought to remember. Tom blinked. The blue star was moving. He watched it drift across the star field until it intercepted another bright pinpoint, this one a brilliant green. There was a flash as the two tiny lights met. When the blue spark moved on, the green was no more. Now, what were the chances I'd witness that? How likely to be looking at just the right place at the right time? The battle must still be pretty hot and heavy up there. It isn't over yet. Tom tried to rise, but his body sagged back against the bed of vines. Okay, try again. He rolled over onto one elbow, paused to marshal his strength, then pushed upright. Kithrop's small, dim moons were absent, but there was enough starlight to make out the eerie weedscape. Water sluiced through the shifting morass. There were croaking and slithering sounds. Once he heard a tiny scream that choked off. Some small prey suddenly dying, he supposed. He was thankful for the obstinacy that had brought him to this modest height. Even 2 meters made a difference. He couldn't have survived a night down in that loathsome mess. He turned stiffly and began groping through his meager supplies on the crude sledge. First priority was to get warm. He pulled the top piece of his wetsuit from the jumbled pile and gingerly slid into it. Tom knew he should give some attention to his wounds, but they could wait just a little longer. So could a full meal. He had salvaged enough stores for a few of those. Munching on a food bar and taking sparing sips from a canteen, Tom appraised his small pile of equipment. At the moment, what mattered were his 3 psi bombs. He looked up at the sky. Except for a faint purple haze near 1 bright star, there were no more signs of the battle. Yet that one glimpse had been enough. Tom already knew which bomb to set off. Jillian had spent a few hours with the Nis machine before leaving Streaker to meet him at Toshio's Island. She had connected the Timbrimi device to the Thenanin microbranch library he had salvaged. Then she and the Nis had worked out the proper signals to load into the bombs. The most important was the Thenanin distress call. Ifni's fickle luck permitting, it would let Tom perform the crucial experiment to find out if the plan would work. All of the work Suessi and Tisht and the others had put into the Trojan Seahorse would come to naught if Thenanin were not amongst those left in the war. What use would it be for Streaker to slip inside a hollowed-out Thenanin hulk, to rise into space in disguise, if all the combatants would shoot anyway at a remnant of a faction which had already lost? Tom picked up one psi-bomb. It was spherical and rested in his hand like an orb. At the top was a safety switch and timer. Jillian had carefully labeled each bomb on a strip of tape. On this one she had added a flowing signature and a small heart with an arrow through it. Tom smiled and brought the bomb to his lips. He had felt guilty of machismo, insisting on being the one to come here while she remained behind. Now he knew he had been right. Tough and competent as Jillian was, she wasn't as good a pilot as he, and probably would have died in the crash. She certainly wouldn't have had the physical strength to haul the sledge this far. Hell, he thought. I'm glad because she's safe with friends who'll protect her. That's reason enough. She may be able to lick 10 Blenchuk cave lizards with one hand tied, but she's my lady, and I'll not let harm come near her if I can help it. The complaining volcano thundered and rumbled, reminding him ironically of Mount Diana, when he had last seen it, spilling molten magma down the towering, shelving slope of Aphrodite Terra, that continent whose flanks were washed by the searing, bone-dry ghost of a primeval Dead Sea. Under the sulphurous clouds of Venus, those lava flickerings had illuminated another long night of all-too-well-remembered pain, only this nearby Kithrupan fumarole would have barely glimmered on mighty Diana's distant fiery shoulders. Anyway, on Venus, night has no end. There, too, he had lain amid rubble, half-broken, wondering whether he was going to live or die. Through his pitted helmet visor, he had watched infrared trails through the choking atmosphere left by a slow rain of faraway descending comets, hurtling ice balls whose targeted plummet seemed aimed just over the curved horizon, beyond the reach of sight or sound. He had been young and naive then, or else he never would have trusted a stranger's word that the hired dirigiplane was fully checked out for a quick dash across Ella's burning sands, a stranger who, Tom later recalled, had never once looked him in the eye while filling out the rental forms. First impressions can be wrong, he contemplated, after barely surviving the crash, but when in doubt, trust what your senses tell you. Then, too, the overwhelming sensation had been of frustration and failure. With information in his pouch, the Venus terraforming project might yet manage to hold on to its alien advisors, galactics from the Institute for Progress, who were due to pull out the very next day, dismissing as quixotic the quaint human dream of awakening seas already dead for 3 billion years. With their knowledge and technological aid, miracles might yet happen, if only the advisors could be persuaded to stay. If the data reached them in time. He shuddered, remembering that earlier trial. The similarities were deceiving. On Venus, help had been just an hour away, and the issues, while serious, weren't as horrific. And on Venus, the problem was to keep from burning up. A chill breeze penetrated his damp clothes, setting his teeth briefly chattering. Still, from now on, maybe I'd better make a point of staying away from volcanoes. Tom washed down the last of the protein bar. He hefted the bomb and considered strategy. His original plan had been to land near the volcano, wait until the glider had recharged for launching, then plant the bomb and take flight before it went off. He could have ridden thermals from the volcano to a good altitude and found another island from which to watch the results of his experiment. Lacking another island, he still could have gone far enough, landed in the ocean, and used his telescope to watch from there. It was a nice plan, foiled by a raging storm and an unexpected jungle of mad vines. His telescope had joined the metal detritus at the bottom of Kithrop's World Sea, along with most of the wreckage of his solar plane. Tom rose carefully to his feet. Food and warmth made it merely an exercise in controlled agony. Rummaging through his few belongings, he tore a long, narrow strip of cloth from the tattered ruins of his sleeping bag. The swatch of tough, insew silk seemed adequate. The Psi-bomb felt heavy and substantial in his hand. It was hard to imagine the globe stuffed with powerful illusions, a super-potent counterfeit, ready to burst free on command. He set the timer for 2 hours and thumbed the safety release, arming the thing. He laid it carefully into his makeshift sling. Tom knew he was being dramatic. Distance wouldn't help all that much. Sensors all over the Kithrop system would light up when it went off. He might as well set it off at his feet. Still, one never knew. Might as well toss it as far away as he could. He let the sling sway a few times to get the feel of it. Then he began swinging it. Slowly, at first, he built up momentum, while a strange feeling of well-being spread outward from his chest into his arms and legs. Fatigue seemed to fall away. He started to sing. Oh, Daddy was a caveman. He fought in skins, no shirts. He dreamed of lights up in the sky while scratching in the dirt. Your ETs and your stars. Oh, Daddy the bold fighter slew his cousins, fourth and third. He dreamed of peace eternally and died speared to the earth. You ETs and your stars. Oh, Daddy was a lover, and yet he beat his wife. He dreamed, longing for sanity, regretting all his life. You ETs and your stars. Yes, and Daddy was a leader. He dreamed, yet still told lies. He got the frightened masses to put missiles in the skies. You ETs and your stars. My daddy was unlearned, but ever on he tried. He hated his damned ignorance and struggled with his pride. He stepped up on a bootstrap, then, and upon nothing, cried. That tragic orphan willed to me a mind and heart, then died. So scorn me as a wolfling, sneer at my orphan scars. But tell me, boys, what's your excuse? You ETs and your stars. You ETs and your stars. Tom's shoulders flexed as he took a step. His arm snapped straight, and he released the sling. The bomb sailed high into the night, whirling like a top. The spinning sphere shone briefly, still climbing, sparkling, until it disappeared from sight. He listened, but never heard it land. Tom stood still for a while, breathing deeply. Well, he thought at last, that built an appetite. I have 2 hours to eat, tend my wounds, and prepare a shelter. Any time I get after that, O Lord, will be accepted with humble gratitude. He laid the ragged strip of cloth over his shoulder and turned to prepare himself a meal by starlight. Part 5. Concussion. In a world older and more complex than ours, they move finished and complete, gifted with extensions of the senses we have lost or never attained, living by voices we shall never hear. They are other nations caught with ourselves in the net of life and time. Henry Bateson. Chapter 46. Sound. It was evening, and the Kiqui were leaving for their hunting grounds. Saut heard them squeaking excitedly as they gathered in a clearing west of the toppled drill tree. The hunters passed not far from the pool on their way to a rock chimney on the southern slope of the island, chittering and puffing their lung sacs in pomp. Saut listened until the abos were gone. Then he sank a meter below the surface and blew depressed bubbles. Nothing was going right. Denny had changed, and he didn't like it. Instead of her usual delightful skittishness, she virtually ignored him. Worse, she had listened to two of his best limericks and answered seriously, completely missing the delicious double entendres. In spite of the importance of her studies of the Kiqui, Takata Jim had ordered her also to analyze the drill tree system for Charles Dart. Twice she had gone into the water to collect samples from below the metal mound. She had ignored Saut's nuzzling advances, or even more disturbing, petted him absently in return. Saut realized that for all of his previous efforts to break her down, he hadn't really wanted her to change, at least not this way. He drifted unhappily until a tether attached to one of the sleds brought him up short, reminding him of the worst affront of all. His new assignment kept him linked to this electrical obscenity, chafed and cramped in a tiny pool while his real work was out on the open sea with the pre-sentients. When Jillian and Kipiru left, he had assumed their absence would free him to do pretty much what he wanted. Ha! No sooner had the pilot and physician left than did Toshio step in and assume command. I should have been able to talk rings around him. How in the five galaxies did the boy manage to get the upper hand? But here he was, stuck monitoring a damned robot for a pompous, egocentric chimpanzee who cared only about rocks. The dumb little robot didn't even have a brain one could talk to. You don't have conversations with microprocessors. You tell them what to do, then helplessly watch the disaster when they take you literally. His harness gave off a chime. It was time to check on the probe. Saut clucked a sarcastic response. Yes, in duty, lord and master, metal moron and disaster. Beep again. I'll work faster. Saut brought his left eye even with the sled's screen. He sent a pulse code to the robot, and a stream of data returned. The bot had finally digested the most recent rock sample. He ordered the probe's small memory emptied into the sled's databanks. Toshio had run him through the drill until Saut could control the bot almost unconsciously. He made it anchor one end of a monofilament line to the rough rock, then lower itself another 50 meters. The old explanation for the hole beneath the metal mound had been discarded. The drill tree couldn't have needed to dig a tunnel a kilometer deep in search of nutrients. It shouldn't have been able to pierce the crust that far. The mass of the drill root was clearly too great to have been rotated by the modest tree that once stood atop the mound. The amount of material excavated wouldn't fit atop 10 metal mounds. It was found as sediment all around the high ridge on which the mound sat. To Saut, these mysteries weren't enticing. They only proved once again that the universe was weird, and that maybe humans and dolphins and chimps ought to wait a while before challenging its deeper puzzles. The robot finished its descent. Saut made it reach out and seize the cavity wall with diamond-tipped claws, then retract its tether from above. Down in stages it would go. For this little machine there would be no rising. Saut felt that way himself sometimes, especially since coming to Kithrop. He didn't really expect ever to leave this deadly world. Fortunately, the probe sampling routine was fairly automatic once triggered. Even Charles Dart should have little excuse to complain, unless... Saut cursed. There it was again, the static that had plagued the probe since it had passed the half-kilometer mark. Toshio and Kipiru had worked on it and couldn't find the problem. The crackling was unlike any static Saud had ever heard. Not that he was an expert on static. It had a syncopation of sorts. Not all that unpleasant to listen to, actually. Saud had heard that some people liked to listen to white noise. Certainly nothing was more undemanding. The clock on his harness ticked away. Saud listened to the static and thought about perversities, about love and loneliness. I swim, circles, like the others, and learn, sadly, I am, sightlessly, sighing, alone. Slowly, Saud realized he had adopted the rhythm of the noise below. He shook his head, but when he listened again, it was still there. A song. It was a song. Saud concentrated. It was like trying to follow all parts of a six-part fugue at the same time, the patterns interleaved with an incredible complexity. No wonder they had all thought it noise. Even he had barely caught on. His harness timer chimed, but Saud didn't notice. He was too busy listening to the planet sing to him. Chapter 47 Streaker. Moki and Haoki had both volunteered for guard duty, but for different reasons. Both enjoyed getting out of the ship for a change, and neither dolphin particularly minded having to stay plugged into a sled for hours at a stretch in the dark, silent waters outside the ship. But beyond that, they differed. Haoki was there because he felt it was a necessary job. Moki, on the other hand, hoped guard duty would give him a chance to kill something. I wish Takata Jim sent me after Aki instead of Kathad John, Moki rasped. I could have tracked the smart ass just as well. Moki's sled rested about 20 yards from Haoki's on the high underwater bluff overlooking the ship. Arc lamps still shone on Streaker's hull, but the area was deserted now, off limits to all but those few cleared by the vice captain. Moki looked at Haoki through the flexible bubble dome of his sled. Haoki was silent, as usual. He had ignored Moki's comment completely. Arrogant spawn of a stink squid. Haoki was another Tersiop smart aleck like Crydike, and that stuck-up little midship fin, Aki. Moki made a small sound sculpture in his mind. It was an image of ramming and tearing. Once he had put Crydike in the role of the victim, the captain who had so often caught him gold-bricking and embarrassed him by correcting his Anglic grammar, had finally got his just deserts. Moki was glad. But now he needed another fantasy target. It was no fun to imagine ripping into nobody in particular. The Calafian Aki served well when it was discovered that the young middy had betrayed the vice-captain. Moki had hoped to be the one sent after Aki, but Takata Jim had ordered Kathad John out instead, explaining that the purpose was to bring Aki back for discipline, not to commit murder. The giant had seemed oblivious to such nice distinctions when he departed equipped with a powerful laser rifle. Perhaps Takata Jim had less than perfect control over Kathad John, and had sent him away for his own safety. From the gleam in Kathad John's eye, Moki did not envy the Calafian when the youth was found. Let Kathad John have, Aki. One small pleasure lost didn't take much away from Moki's overall joy. It was good to be big for a change. On his off-duty time, everybody got out of Moki's way, as if he was a pod leader. Already he had his eye on one or two of those sexy little females in Mackinney's sickbay. Some of the younger males looked good, too. Moki wasn't particular. They would all come around soon enough when they saw the way the current pulled. He briefly resisted an urge, but couldn't help himself. He let out a short skirr of triumph in a forbidden form. Glory is glory. Biting is and glory. Female submit. A new bull is. He saw Haoki react at last. The other guard jerked slightly and raised his head to regard Moki. He was silent, though, as Moki met his eye defiantly. Moki sent a focused beam of sonar directly at Haoki to show he was listening to him, too. Arrogant stink squid. Haoki would get his, too, after Takata Jim had locked his jaws on the situation, and the men of Earth would never disapprove, because Big Human Metz was at Takata Jim's side, agreeing with everything. Moki let out another squeal of primal, tasting the forbidden primitiveness with delight. It pulled at something deep inside him. Each taste brought on further hunger for it. Let Haoki click in disgust. Moki dared even the Galactics to come and try to interfere with him and his new captain. Haoki bore Moki's bestial squawking stoically, but it reminded him that he had joined up with a gang of cretins and misfits. Unfortunately, the cretins and misfits were right, and the brightest of Streaker's crew were caught up in a disastrous misadventure. Haoki was desperately sad over the crippling of Kraidaiki. The captain had obviously been among the best the breed could produce, but the accident had made possible a quiet and perfectly legal change in policy, and he couldn't regret that. Takata Jim at least recognized the foolishness of pursuing the desperate Trojan seahorse scheme. Even a Streaker could be moved silently to the Thenanin wreck, and if Tisht's crew had miraculously set things up so Streaker could wear the Hulk as a gigantic disguise, and actually take off under those conditions, what would that win them? Even if Thomas Orley had reported that Thenanin were still in the battle in space, there remained the question of fooling those Thenanin into coming to rescue a supposed lost battleship and escorting it to the rear. A dubious chance. The question was moot. Orley was obviously dead. There had been no word for days, and now the gamble had turned into a desperate wish. Why not just give the thrice-damned Galactics what they want? Why this romantic nonsense of saving the data for the Terrigan's Council? What do we care about a bunch of dangerous, long-lost hulks, anyway? It's obviously no business of ours if the Galactics want to fight over the derelict fleet. Even the Kithrop Aboriginals weren't worth dying for. It all seemed plain to Haoki. It was also apparent to Takata Jim, whose intelligence Haoki respected. But if it was so obvious, why did people like Kraidaiki and Orley and Hikahi disagree? Quandaries like this were the sort of thing that had kept Haoki a subsec in the engine room instead of trying for non-com or officer, as his test scores indicated. Moki blatted out another boast phrase in primal. It was even louder this time. The Stenos was trying to get a rise out of him. Haoki sighed. Many of the crew had begun behaving that way. Not quite as bad as Moki, but bad enough. And it wasn't just Stenos, either. As morale dissolved, so did the motivation to maintain Kanink, to keep up the daily fight against the animal side that always wanted out. One would hardly have been able to predict, weeks ago, who later turned out to be the most susceptible. Of course, all the best crew fen were away, with Suessi and Hikahi. Fortunately, Haoki thought. He dwelt on the irony of good going to bad, and right coming out of wrong. At least Takata Jim seemed to understand how he felt, and didn't hold it against him. The vice-captain had taken Haoki's support with gratitude. He heard Moki's tail thrash, but before the angry little Stenos could voice another taunt, both of their sled speakers came to life. Haoki and Moki, Comsec Finn Huerta Pete calling. Acknowledge. The call was from the ship's comm and detection operator. The fact that the jobs had been combined showed just how bad things were. "Roger, Aoki here. Moki's indisposed at the moment. What's up?" He heard Moki choke a protest, but it was clear the Finn would be a while reformatting his mind for Anglic. "We have a sonic bogey to the east, Aoki. Sounds like a sled. If hostile, destroy. If it's someone from the island, they must be turned back. If they refuse, shoot to disable the sled." "Understood. Aoki and Moki on our way." "All right, Gabby," he told the speech-tied Moki. Aoki gave his partner a long, narrow grin. "Let's check it out and watch that trigger. We're only enforcing a quarantine. We don't shoot at crewmates unless we absolutely have to." With a neural impulse, he turned his sled motor on. Without looking back, he lifted off from the muddy rise, then accelerated slowly to the east. Moki watched Aoki head out before turning his sled to follow. "Tempted, tempted, tempted, Moki, is temptation. Delicious, is. The sleds dropped, one after another, into the gloom. On a passive sonar screen, there were small blurry dots that drifted slowly past the shadow of the seamount, then disappeared behind it. Kipiru opened his harness's right claw and dropped the portable listening unit. It tumbled down to the soft ooze. He turned to Jillian. "Done and gone. They chase our shadows. They'll not like to catch false prey." Jillian had expected guards. Several kilometers back, they had left the sled on delayed automatic and swam off to the north and west. By the time the sled started up again, they had circled to within a few hundred yards of the outlock. Jillian touched Kipiru's flank. The sensitive hide trembled under her hand. "You remember the plan, Kipiru?" "Need you ask?" Jillian raised an eyebrow in surprise. A triple upsweep trill and a wavering interrogative click? That was an unusually brief and straightforward reply for Trinary. Kipiru was capable of more subtlety than she had thought. "Of course not, dear bow wave rider. I apologize. I'll do my part and not worry for a moment about you doing yours." Kipiru looked at her as if wishing he didn't have to wear a breather, as if he wanted to speak to her in her native language. Jillian felt some of this in a gentle telepathic touch. She hugged his smooth gray torso. "You take care, Kipiru. Remember that you're admired and loved. Very much so." The pilot tossed his head. "To swimming or battle, to warning or rescue, to earning your trust." They dropped over the edge of the bluff and swam quickly for the ship's outer lock. Chapter 48. Takata Jim. It was impossible to rest. Takata Jim envied humans the total unconsciousness they called sleep. When a man lay down for the night, his awareness of the world disappeared, and the nerves to his muscles deactivated. If he did dream, he usually didn't have to participate physically. Even a neo-dolphin couldn't just turn himself off that way. One or the other hemisphere of the brain was always on sentry duty to control his breathing. Sleep, for a Finn, was both a milder and a far more serious thing. He knocked about the captain's stateroom, wishing he could go back to his own smaller cabin. But symbolism was important to the crew he had inherited. His followers needed more than the logic of legality to confirm his command. They needed to see him as the new bull, and that meant living in the style of the former herd leader. He took a long breath at the surface and emitted clicks to illuminate the room in sound images. Rydaiki certainly had eclectic tastes. Ifni knew what sort of things the former captain had owned, which couldn't stand wetness, and had therefore been stowed away before Streaker landed on Kithrim. The collection that remained was striking. Works by artists of a dozen sentient races lay sealed behind glass cases. Sound-stroke photos of strange worlds and weird aberrant stars adorned the walls. Krydyke's music system was impressive. He had recordings by the thousands, songs and eerie things that made Takata Jim's spine crawl when he played them. The collection of whale ballads was valuable, and a large fraction appeared to have been collected personally. By the desk comm there was a photo of Krydyke with the officers of the James Cook. Captain Helene Alvarez herself had signed it. The famous explorer had her arm over her dolphin exec's broad, smooth back as she and Krydyke mugged for the camera. Takata Jim had served on important ships, cargo vessels supplying the Atlas and Calafia colonies, but he had never been on missions like those of the legendary Cook. He had never seen such sights, nor heard such sounds. Until the shallow cluster, until they found dead ships the size of moons. He thrashed his tail in frustration. His flukes struck the ceiling painfully. His breath came heavily. It didn't matter. Nothing that he had done would matter if he succeeded. If he got Streaker away from Kithrop with her crew alive, if he did that, he would have a photo of his own, and the arm on his back would be that of the President of the Confederacy of Earth. A shimmering collection of tiny motes began to collect to his right. The sparkles coalesced into a holographic image a few inches from his eye. "Yes, what is it?" he snapped. An agitated dolphin, harness arms flexing and unflexing, nodded nervously. It was the ship's purser, Suppa.
"Sir, something strange has happened. We weren't sure we should wake you, but
Takata Jim found the Finn's underwater Anglic almost indecipherable. Suppa's upper register warbled uncontrollably. "Calm down and talk slowly," he commanded sharply. The Finn flinched, but made an effort to obey.
I was in the outlock. I heard someone say there was an alert. Quirkapete sent Haoki and Moki after sled sounds.
Why wasn't I informed?" Suppa recoiled in dismay. For a moment he appeared too frightened to speak. Takata Jim sighed and kept his voice calm. "Never mind, not your fault. Go on." Visibly relieved, Suppa continued.
Few minutes later, the light on the personnel outlock came on. Wadasetti went over, and I paid no heed. But when Life Cleaner and Wormhole Pilot entered..."
Takata Jim spumed. Only dire need to hear Suppa's story without delay prevented him from crashing about the room in frustration.
"Tried to stop them, as you ordered, but Wadasetti and Hiska were doing backflips of joy and dashed about fetching for them both."
"Where are they now?" Takata Jim demanded.
"Baskin entered the main bay with Wadasetti. Hiska is off, spreading rumors throughout the ship. Kipuro took a sled and breathers and is gone."
"Gone where?"
"Back out,"
Suppa wailed. His command of Anglic was rapidly dissolving. Takata Jim took advantage of what composure the purser had left. "Have Herkapete awaken Dr. Metz. Have Metz meet me at sick bay with three guards. You are to go to the dry wheel dressing room with Sawtooth, and let no one enter. Understood?" Suppa nodded vigorously, and his image vanished. Takata Jim prayed that Herkapete would have the sense to recall Moki and Haoki and send them after Kipiru. Together, between Haoki's brains and Moki's feral ruthlessness, they might be able to cut the pilot off before he reached the Thenanin wreck. "Why isn't Katha John back yet? I chose him to go after that middy in order to get him out of the ship for a while. I was afraid he was becoming dangerous even to me. I wanted some time to organize without him around, but now the Baskin woman's returned sooner than I expected.
Maybe I should have kept Cathajan around. The giant's talents might be useful about now.
Takata Jim whistled the door open and swam out into the hall. He faced a confrontation he had hoped to put off for at least another 40 hours, if not indefinitely. Should I have seen Decrydike before this? It would have been easy. A power failure in his gravity tank, a switched catheter. Metz would not approve, but there was already much Metz did not know. Much that Takata Jim wished he didn't know. He swam hard for the intra-hull lift. Maybe I won't need Cathajan in order to deal with Jillian Baskin, he thought. After all, what can one human female do?
Chapter 49 The Psi-Bomb. The mound of partly dried weeds formed a dome on the sea of vines. Tom had propped up a low roof using salvaged bits of strutting from his sledge, making a rude cave. He sat at the entrance, waiting in the pre-dawn dimness, and munched one of his scarce food bars. His wounds were cleaned as well as possible, and coated with hardening dabs of medicinal foam. With food in his stomach and some of the pain put down, he almost felt human again. He examined his small osmotic still. The upper part, a clear bag with a filtered spout at one end, held a thick layer of salt water and sludge. Below the filter, one of his canteens sat almost filled. Tom looked at his watch. Only 5 minutes remained. There was no time to dip for another load of scummy water to feed the still. He wouldn't even be able to clean the filters before the bomb went off. He picked up the canteen, screwed its cap tight, and slipped it into a thigh pouch. Then he popped the filter out of its frame and shook most of the sludge out, before folding it tightly and tucking it under his belt. The filter probably didn't take all the dissolved metal salts out of the water. It hadn't been designed with Kithrop in mind. Nonetheless, the little package was probably his most valuable possession. 3 minutes, the glowing numbers on his watch told him. Tom looked up at the sky. There was a vague brightening in the east, and the stars were starting to fade. It would be a clear morning, and therefore bitterly cold. He shivered and zipped the wetsuit tight. He pulled in his knees. Again Venus came to mind, perhaps because then, too, his fate and all he cared about had hung upon sending a message. Only there it had been for succor. Moreover, his enemies had been few and furtive, while all around him friendly humans and aliens had roamed the steaming skies searching for a slender clue he had only to provide. This time matters were reversed. Friends were the scarce commodity, while his signal would be a shout, a scream directed at countless foes. Enemies who, at best, would willingly rack his body and strain his brain pan for what it contained. Yet he must strive to bring them here, down here, almost to this very spot. How do I keep getting into jams like this? 1 minute. When it came, it would be like the loudest sound he had ever heard, like the brightest light. There would be no keeping it out. He wanted to cover his ears and eyes as if against a real explosion. Instead, he stared at a point on the horizon and counted, pacing each breath. Deliberately, he let himself slide into a trance. 7, 8, 9, 10. A lightness filled his chest. The feeling spread outward, numbing and soothing. Light from the few stars in the west diffracted spiderweb rays through his barely separated eyelashes as he awaited a soundless explosion.
Sout, I said I'm ready to take over now.
Sout squirmed and looked up at Toshio.
Just another few minutes, okay? I'm listening to something.
Toshio frowned. This was not what he had expected from Sout. He had come to relieve the dolphin linguist early because Sout hated working with the robot probe.
What's going on, Tosh?
Denny sat up in her sleeping bag, rubbing her eyes, peering in the pre-dawn dark.
"I offered to take over the robot so Sout wouldn't have to deal with Charlie when he calls, but he refuses to let go."
Denny shrugged.
"Then I'd say that's his business. What do you care, anyway?"
Toshio felt a sharp answer rise to his lips, but he kept them locked and turned away. He would ignore Denny until she wakened fully and decided to behave civilly.
This ends side one of Cassette 7.